This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the number of refugees and other displaced people is growing faster than the humanitarian community's ability to address the problem.
That's correspondent Heather Murdoch reporting from Geneva. Details next. Also, Boko Haram militants have attacked a fishing village in western Chad, killing 14 people. And the wife of Zimbabwe's vice president has asked judges to free her on bail 4 days after she was arrested for allegedly attempting to murder her husband. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, there are 70 million displaced people in the world, a number that has doubled in 20 years. Of those, nearly 26 million are refugees, and most of them are sheltered in developing countries already burdened by other huge challenges. Today, the United Nations Global Refugee Forum ends in Geneva, where delegates sought to find ways to ease the refugee crisis. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is there, and she spoke with my colleague Steve Miller about the forum, which drew 3,000 delegates from refugee communities, national governments, corporations, and aid organizations.
The issue, the overreaching issue that they're trying to address is that currently the number of refugees and other displaced people is growing faster than the humanitarian community's ability to address the problems and find solutions for people.
As you mentioned, there's 70 million people who are displaced or refugees right now, and this is the impetus for this conference and this summit. What is the United Nations Office of Human Rights and the UNHCR really trying to achieve as a deliverable from this meeting?
What they're trying to do is obtain pledges from countries and from private organizations and other aid organizations for things like additional aid. Western countries, they're asking for additional spaces for people that want to resettle. That's one huge problem they face, is that people would happily, legally resettle in third countries and safe countries, except there's not enough places granted by the governments in the countries they want to go to. They're also trying to encourage governments that host a lot of refugees to change some policies to allow refugees to have access to work and education. And one thing that they're trying to also stress is that most of the refugees in the world live in developing countries. These countries have less resources to give them. So the UNHCR and the United Nations is trying to encourage rich countries to do more to alleviate the burden for poorer countries that are hosting most of the refugees.
Traditionally, you are VOA's Middle East correspondent, and you cover a wide variety of issues, but you're in Geneva now. But you have also recently spoken to refugees from Libya, as I understand.
Yes, I've reported from Libya a few times this year, and spent quite a bit of time with refugees traveling from other African countries to Libya with the intention of trying to go from on the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. And most of those people actually would love to be resettled through the UNHCR into a third country. But the UNHCR tells me that first they identify the vulnerable people among this group to resettle to usually Europe, America, or Canada. And then even after that, they can only resettle about 5% of the people that they have identified as vulnerable, illegally eligible, and in dire need of resettlement. So he also called this trip, often from war or genocide, as in the case of Darfur, to the coast of Libya, one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world happening right now, some of the worst abuses in the world, where most people who go to take that trip, they travel through southern Libya, where often women are raped, people are kidnapped, smugglers hold people in detention, demanding ransom from their families. So they're demanding ransom money from some of the poorest people in the world, are paying exorbitant amounts to smugglers in order to save the lives of their loved ones. The other thing he said is that on that journey, they don't have any records of how many people have died on the way from African countries, from southern African countries or middle African countries to Libya. And he said he suspects that it's possible that more people die on the way to the coast than actually die in the Mediterranean Sea on the way to Europe.
That was correspondent Heather Murdoch in Geneva speaking with VOA Steve Miller. The Global Refugee Forum follows up on the Global Compact on Refugees proposed in 2018 by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which organized this event. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips caught up with Leonard Zulu, UNHCR's Deputy Director for its regional office in Southern Africa. Mr. Zulu seemed heartened by the energy and resolve shown by political leaders both within Africa and beyond.
Well, yes, as we opened the forum, already more than 700 concrete pledges had been put on the table. For example, one country in Southern Africa will be making available 70 places in their universities for refugees. We're just waiting for the minister to make the announcement. And another country, Zambia, will be making pledges to provide 10 hectares of arable land to refugees and former refugees who will be able to use that land to become self-sufficient and locally integrate. They are also planning to provide to former refugees the possibility to regularize their stay in Zambia for a long duration of time.
I understand there's already been some wonderful pledges by European governments.
The government of Denmark yesterday made a contribution of 10 million Danish crowns to support building asylum systems so that when refugees arrive in a country, they'll be able to be processed quickly and their status recognized to countries that are having difficulties making quick status determination decisions and have got a backlog where people have been waiting for many years for a decision to be rendered.
Reading the press release for the Global Refugee Forum, I noticed a tone where what's being sought and pledged are very practical solutions. There were very, very few of those well-meaning abstractions one normally sees in aid and development literature.
Pledges are quite concrete, they are measurable, and in 2 years' time, participants have committed to come back together and assess their progress. And remember, these are voluntary pledges. Nobody is compelled to make an offer of what they're going to do. It's the countries themselves now having the political will, making offers that would make refugees self-reliant. And that would relieve the burden that is placed on some of the frontline countries that receive refugees in great numbers.
You mentioned that countries, NGOs, human rights and development experts are all really well represented at the Global Refugee Forum. What about refugees themselves? Are they there too?
Yes, refugees are part of the meeting, which is a very good thing. It's very important, it's critical that we don't talk about refugees without refugees in the room. So they are participating, they are moderating, so they can articulate those human needs and really put their human face to the policy undertaking being made.
In the spirit of the Global Compact on Refugees that this forum is based on, integrating refugees with their host cultures has to work both ways. It said that national citizens should also share in the benefits of development assistance and opportunities.
Yes, the Global Compact on Refugees is really a game changer, integrating the needs of the refugees into the national development plan and the national response and strengthening the national services, national capacities, the national delivery system, and to be able to provide services to both the host community and the refugee community equally. So in that sense, there will be no distinction. No one will be left behind. Remember, the host community are the first responders. They're the ones that receive the refugees before the international community responds or the big UN agencies respond. So it's only fair and reasonable that when you're providing assistance, you're not just assisting the refugees, but also the host community, who are really sometimes living in marginalized or fragile areas where there's a need for development to be strengthened.
That was Leonard Zulu, the UNHCR's Deputy Director for Southern Africa, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. In South Sudan, since 2004, the United Nations has destroyed over 1 million explosive devices, including landmines and cluster munitions, scattered across the country from decades of conflict. The United Nations Mine Action Service says the unexplosive ordinances poses a threat to farmers and villagers, but they expect to clear the remaining explosives within 6 years. Sheila Pony reports from Magua County, South Sudan.
Mary Moyoyo Joseph was collecting tall grass near their village a year ago to cover the roof of her home when she stepped on a landmine. I had no idea there was something there. I only remember a dull sound, like dim. And the next thing I remember was being on the ground in terrible pain. Mary Joseph is one of more than 3,500 people in South Sudan who have lost limbs or have been injured by unexploded ordnance since the demining began 15 years ago, and nearly 1,400 have been killed. The United Nations Mine Action Service, UNMAS, has now reduced that explosive threat down to 27 square kilometers of land across South Sudan. That represents progress of the 1,800 minefields recorded. There are only 184 left to clear, along with 128 non-cluster munitions strikes. But Richard Bolter, the program manager for UNMIS in South Sudan, says it is tedious, time-consuming work.
The minimum metal mines have minimum metal in them, which means we have to investigate every single piece of metal as we're clearing the ground. So it is a slow process. The average deminer clears 20 square meters in a day. That's an area 4 meters by 5 meters, not much bigger than a single room.
Despite the challenge, UNMIS expects to clear all remaining minefields, cluster munition strikes, and battlefields within 6 years by 2026. However, the head of South Sudan's National Mine Action Agency, Jorchuk Barach Jorchuk, says to accomplish that, villagers need to play a part when they find any suspected explosives.
The mine action business is not only for those who are working in it. It is a collective responsibility for the nationals, citizens, have to report whatever they see.
UNMIS cautions that even after all the known minefields and battlefields are cleared in South Sudan, it could take years, even decades, to find and eliminate remnants of yet undiscovered explosives. But every landmine or explosive they destroy means one less possible casualty from this deadly legacy of conflict. Sheila Pony for VOA News, Magui County, South Sudan.
Boko Haram militants attacked a fishing village in western Chad, killing 14 people. Authorities in Chad say 13 people are missing after the attack, which occurred yesterday. The regional prefect told the French news agency that a small group first attacked Kayiga, a village in the marshland along Lake Chad. A group of reinforcements then joined the attack. VOA journalists in the region haven't been able to verify the reports. The area is remote and sits near where the borders of Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, and Niger meet. The Boko Haram militants have been fighting to spread a radical form of Islam in northeastern Nigeria for a decade. About 35,000 people have died in the fighting, which has spilled into neighboring nations. Around 2 million people have fled their homes to escape the violence. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz, on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. 20 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Today, the United Nations Global Refugee Forum ends in Geneva, where delegates sought to find ways to to ease the refugee crisis. And Boko Haram militants have attacked a fishing village in western Chad, killing 14 people. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Hundreds of Kigali residents became homeless this week because government workers are destroying their homes. City officials say the homes were built in wetlands that are at high risk of natural disasters. Eugene Uimana has more details from Rwanda's capital.
That is the sound of men demolishing houses. They are making jokes, but the owners of the houses are shedding tears. On the streets around this Kigali neighborhood, residents sit surrounded by heaps of saucepans, bed sheets, and other household items. Some sob as they talk about what has happened. This woman says she paid her landlord, but look, they are throwing us out. She says begged him to give her even money for a ticket, but he refused. She says she and her children will be street beggars. The Rwandan government says it gave the residents enough warning about the demolition plan and had several meetings urging them to voluntarily leave the wetlands, but they did not. Some residents, however, say their homes weren't in the wetlands, and the crime is that their houses are shabby. This man says that to build these houses, we bought plots, not wetlands. Do you see the wetland here? He says the destruction is a very bad injustice. Under the relocation policy, people who own the property they were occupying at the time of demolition can receive 60,000 Rwandan francs or $64 for temporary accommodation. Renters, however, get no payment, and most of them cannot afford to rent homes in better locations. They say the government needs to help them. This man says, we have obeyed. We don't have any other choice, but it is very hard. We respect our government. We didn't want to fight. He says, calls on President Kagame to come to the rescue. Kigali city leaders say the relocations must continue to make sure that people aren't living in high-risk zones. Gwamburangwa Stephen leads the Gasabo district in Kigali City. Stephen says we have to take care of our people's lives. We keep working with the residents to relocate them and build in places where their lives are secured. He says the city will keep the pledge of paying accommodation to those who are eligible. About 10,000 hectares of Kigali City is wetlands, which are at risk of floods and landslides. City officials say it needs to demolish 7,222 homes in wetlands to prevent disasters. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Lawyers for Mary Chiwenga, the wife of Zimbabwe's vice president, Constantino Chiwenga, have asked judges to free her on bail 4 days after she was arrested for allegedly attempting to murder her husband. Columbus Mavunga has the latest from Harare.
Attorney Toana Nyamakuram filed the bail application on behalf of Mary Chiwenga at the High Court on Wednesday. While Nyamakura refused to speak to reporters, Kenny Mbaiwa, the father of the former model, maintained his earlier line and only said, "Justice will prevail at the end of the day, so you do not have to worry about it," he said. According to state prosecutors, when Vice President Chiwenga was flown to South Africa for medical care in June, Mary Chiwenga forced her husband to stay at a hotel overnight, denying him treatment for about 24 hours. When security agents finally took the vice president to a hospital, his wife allegedly entered his room and removed IV and catheter, resulting in profuse bleeding. Mary Chiwenga was also charged with corruption for allegedly using $1 million in foreign currency, of which there is a shortage in Zimbabwe, to buy houses and luxury vehicles abroad. Alexander Rusero, a senior journalism lecturer at Harare Polytechnic College, says the attempted murder charge might well be true.
When you have a whole vice president accusing his wife of murder, I think there is an element of truth to it. No husband in his entire pride would want to bring or wash dirt linen in the public domain, unless otherwise there is something important, in this case, a life-threatening issue.
At the same time, he thinks the vice president is using his office to get back at his wife, from whom he recently filed for divorce.
It's an exercise of power, an exercise of office that is now being done or characterized, because the truth of the matter is that these are really domestic issues which have nothing to do with the national psyche, which have actually nothing to do with the current efforts that the government might otherwise want to nip the issues of corruption in the bud. They fall away, and they are just a matter of exercising power, a matter of flexing the muscle by the vice president.
Mrs. Chiwenga is facing another charge of trying to obtain an official marriage certificate without the vice president's consent. The Chiwengas were together for years but never formally got married. The state says Mary Chiwenga was attempting to position herself financially and politically in the case the vice president died. State prosecutors are opposed to granting bail, saying Mary Chiwenga has properties outside Zimbabwe and could flee the country to avoid significant jail time. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra, talks about the efforts and challenges to secede from Nigeria. The struggle for independence on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.